The stars continued to shine overhead, but those thin banners of cloud were a lighter gray, as if the sun were beginning to peer over the edge of the world, and the night had that feeling dawn sends ahead of itself. Captain Girard and his officers gave the Emperor a respectful distance as he strode to the taffrail and looked astern. HMS Dauntless followed in the flagship's wake, and it was definitely easier to see her than it had been earlier. Captain Athrawes had been talking quietly to Captain Girard until the Emperor arrived. Now the Sajan nodded to Girard and walked across the deck to stand behind Caleb with his hands clasped behind his own back in an attitude of respectful waiting. The Emperor completed his survey of sky, sea, and wind, then turned to his personal armsman. "Well?" he asked softly.
"Well,"
Merlin agreed, equally softly, with a very slight bow. No one with ears less acute than Merlin's could possibly have heard the exchange through the inevitable background noises of a sailing ship underway at sea. No one else needed to hear, however, and somehow, without actually changing a bit, Caleb's expression seemed to lighten. Merlin's expression didn't, but then he'd already known the answer to Caleb's question. The boat parties of scout snipers had been carefully briefed on exactly where they were supposed to go once they were ashore. As far as General Cherman and his officers were concerned, they'd been dispatched to suspected lookout posts, the places where Emperor Caleb had decided he would have placed sentinels to watch his seaward flank if he were Sir Corin Garvey and feeling particularly paranoid. Some of the Marines had felt the Emperor's precautions were excessive. Others had privately questioned whether their Emperor, for all his prowess as an admiral, had enough of a landsman's eye for terrain to pick out actual observation points from a map. Any of those doubting souls, however, had been wise enough to keep their opinions to themselves. And Caleb had covered himself just a bit by spending 2 days aboard one of the fleet's schooners, perched in her foretop, much to her skipper's considerable anxiety, personally surveying the coastline through a glass. The schooner had obviously been on routine patrol without the crowned personal standard which officially indicated the Emperor's presence on board, and Caleb had dutifully jotted down an entire pad full of notes. No one else had to know that the content of those notes had actually been dictated to him by the Sajan sitting beside him, ostensibly to make certain the Emperor did nothing foolish, like tripping over his own feet and making a large messy spot on the schooner's deck. As it happened, Corin Garvey was indeed paranoid enough to have arranged observation posts. He was only too well aware of the risk he'd taken by adopting his forward deployment in Talbor Pass, and he knew what could happen if a sufficiently large force could be landed in his rear. He had no intention of allowing Caleb to do anything of the sort, however, and he'd established an entire series of interlocking lookout posts that stretched almost 50 miles westward along the Manchir coast from the tip of the Dark Hill Mountains. Each of those posts was equipped with signal flags, and semaphore masts had been located at central points. He'd sought out the highest elevations he could find in order to give his lookouts the greatest visual command of the waters of Whitehorse Reach, and given the relatively low speed of even Carisian galleons, those lookouts would give him a minimum of 6 hours' notice before any hostile landing could commence. They were, of course, dependent upon daylight. If the Carisians were sufficiently confident to risk grounding by approaching the coast under cover of darkness and began landing at the very crack of dawn, they could deprive Garvey's sentinels of that half-dozen hours of approach time. But the lookouts would still be able to flash a warning to him long before any Carisian Marines could reach the southern terminus of Talbor Pass, especially without cavalry. getting his own infantry out of the pass before the Carizians could seal it behind him would become a chancier proposition under those conditions, but he had posted Earl Windshare's cavalry to watch his back. Overall, he had every reason to feel confident that any Carizians in his vicinity would be to the east of him, and he planned to keep them there. If they managed to flank him out of Talbor anyway, he intended to fall back as rapidly as possible on Manchir and the extensive field works whose construction around the capital his father had overseen. In the long run, any waiting game was in Coruscant's favor, especially now that Anvil Rock knew about the Carizian rifles and had begun duplicating them. The one thing Coruscant could not afford was the destruction or neutralization of Garvai's field force. And Garvai was supremely unconcerned by the very real possibility that anyone might question his courage for retreating from one heavily fortified position into another one in the face of an army little more than half the size of his own. Unfortunately for Sir Corin, he had no idea of the reconnaissance capabilities Merlin Athrawis made available to Caleb Armagh. Merlin had sat in on his staff and officers' meetings, had watched and analyzed each of his commanders, studying their strengths and weaknesses. He and Caleb, based on his reports, knew exactly why Garvai had made the command arrangements he had, and overall, Caleb would probably have made the same ones, given the same conditions. But the Emperor also knew from Merlin's reports that there was a potentially fatal flaw in Garvai's command structure, and that was the reason he'd had Merlin pinpoint every one of the Coruscantians' observation posts. Merlin had also plotted their lines of communication and located the positions of the semaphores which formed those lines' central nodes. And, equipped with that information, Caleb had planned the nocturnal landings which had put Sergeant Whiston and his fellows ashore. He'd been very careful to select some suspected lookout posts where, in fact, no one had ever been posted. And he'd been equally careful not to select several which did exist, but which reported through one of the central nodes, rather than having a direct signal link to Garvai's army. It would never have done for him to have unerringly dispatched attacks against every observation post, any more than it would have done for him not to have come up dry at least once or twice. Hopefully, no one would notice that the only ones he'd missed just happened to be unable to tell anyone what they'd seen by signal. Runners were something he couldn't do anything about, but it would take a minimum of several hours for anyone from the surviving positions to get word to Garvai. And that assumed the runners in question figured out what was happening and headed directly for Talbor Pass, instead of first running over to check on why the relay post to which they'd reported hadn't acknowledged their signals. It wasn't a perfect solution to the problem. It was simply a solution which not even the wisest and most cunning of enemy commanders could possibly have seen coming. Garvai's good enough to deserve better than this, Caleb thought. It feels like cheating. But, as Merlin says, if I'm not cheating, I'm not trying hard enough. The Emperor turned his head to sweep his eyes across the eastern horizon one more time. The sky was definitely beginning to brighten, and additional galleons were becoming visible beyond Dauntless. There'd be enough light for his needs by the time the assault boats reached the beaches, he decided, and walked across the broad quarterdeck to Captain Gerard. The sound of his heels on the dew-slick planking was the only sound which was not born of wind or sea, and the flag captain came to respectful attention as Caleb stopped in front of him. "Very well, Captain Gerard," the Emperor said formally. "Show the signal."
"Aye, aye, Your Majesty."
Gerard touched his shoulder in salute and nodded to Lieutenant LaSalle. A moment later, The lit signal lanterns went soaring up to Empress of Chorus's mizzen peak.
"Now, isn't that a pretty sight?"
Edvard Wistan murmured. He stood on the rock where the Coruscantian lookout had been perched the night before, and he had to admit that the fellow had had a breathtaking view out across the sparkling waters of Whitehorse Reach. At the moment, Wistan had come into possession of that view, however, and he suspected that its former owner would have been much unhappier than he was at what he saw so far below him. The transport galleons lay anchored or hove to while their own boats pulled strongly towards the shore. The flat-bottomed assault boats had already landed the men they'd brought with them all the way from Deros, and delighted they must have been to hit the sand, Wistan thought with a grin. Those assault boats had amply proven their worth, but they were Shanwei's own bitch in any sort of seaway. And it was as certain as anything could possibly be that at least one or two of the embarked marines aboard any one of them would fall victim to seasickness.
"And once the first poor unhappy sod pukes, everyone starts to. I'll bet every one of 'em was grass-green and heaving by the time they got ashore."
If so, they'd shown no sign of it, as the first wave of infantry formed up into columns and headed inland. The boats had landed Brigadier Clarake's 3rd Brigade and Brigadier Heyman's 5th Brigade first, followed by Brigadier Josh McIver's 1st Brigade. Now, those 6,000 men were spreading out to screen the inland side of the landing zone, while their assault boats headed out to the waiting galleys to help fetch the other 9,000 men prepared to come ashore behind them. Personally, Wistan figured the odds were less than even that they were going to manage to fully pull off the Emperor's plans. There was too much chance that they'd missed an observation post, or that some random cavalryman would stumble across them, or that some inland signal post would spot them before they could get fully around into the Coruscantian's rear. But that was fine with Edvard Wistan. If it worked, it worked, and the war would probably be well on its way to being over. And even if it didn't work, it would force the Coruscantians to pull out of that damnable position in the pass, without Wistan and his fellow marines being forced to assault those formidable earthworks head-on. Which meant Anina Wistan, of the Earldom of Locare, was much less likely to find herself a widow.
"What?"
Corin Garvai stared at his aide. The lieutenant looked back mutely, his eyes huge, then held out a sheet of paper.
"Here's the signal, sir," he said.
Garvai managed, somehow, to not quite snatch the paper out of the young man's hand. He stepped closer to the open fly of the command tent to get better light, and his eyes flashed over the lines of smudgy pencil. Then he read it again, and a third time. It didn't get any better. He raised his head, gazing sightlessly out of the tent at the everyday business of the encampment around him for what seemed a short eternity. Then he turned back to the senior officers' conference, which had just been so abruptly interrupted.
"Somehow Caleb's gotten round behind us," he said harshly.
Heads jerked up in disbelief, and the officers, standing around the map table, looked back at him with expressions which were almost as stunned as he felt. Baron Barkor's expression went a bit further than that, however. His face froze for a heartbeat, and then Garvai could actually see the blood flowing out of it as it turned the color of cold, congealed gravy. Which was scarcely reassuring, given the fact that Barkor had been promoted to command the entire army's rear guard after his performance at Harrell's Crossing. Garvai had picked him for the position because it was prestigious enough to serve as an ostensible reward for the man
while actually making him, in effect, a mere administrator for the forward position's reserves. Garvey had never intended to commit any of Barkor's men to action under the Baron's own command. Instead, he'd planned to slice off battalions and regiments as required and temporarily assign them to the command of men like Earl Mancora. Mancora, who'd been slightly wounded at Harrell's Crossing but had somehow made it back to the rear with a pitiful handful of his wing, looked equally astounded, but lacked the stunned draft-dragon expression in Barkor's eyes. Unfortunately, Mancora had been assigned to command the farthest forward of the positions in Talbor Pass.
"Which means I've got exactly the wrong men in exactly the wrong places, again," Garvey thought bitterly. "Mancora would have his men on the road within the hour. Langhorne only knows how long it's going to take Barkor to get his arse in motion." "How bad is it, sir?" Mancora asked quietly.
"I'm not sure," Garvey admitted. "According to this, though," he waved the dispatch, "they somehow got ashore in the sector closest to the pass without a single one of our observation posts warning us."
"But that's impossible," Barkor blurted, then added a hasty, "Sir?"
"That's exactly what I would have thought," Garvey agreed grimly. "Unfortunately, we'd both be wrong, my lord. They must have landed right at dawn. How they managed to eliminate our lookouts before they got a single message out is more than I could say, but from this they're already within 15 or 20 miles of the western end of the pass."
Barkor's stunned look was beginning to turn into something entirely too much like panic to suit Garvey.
"Do we have any strength estimates, sir?"
The question came from Colonel Achilles Palzar, the man who'd been Charles Doyle's second in command. Palzar had assumed command of Garvey's artillery following Doyle's capture by the Carizians, and he really should have been officially promoted when he did. It was a temporary oversight Garvey intended to rectify as soon as possible, and at the moment, Palzar's calm voice was a welcome contrast to Barkor.
"No, Colonel. I think, though, that we can assume he's present in strength. We've already determined that he's not the sort of commander to throw out a weak and unsupported force to be chopped up."
Barkor winced visibly at Garvey's reminder of what had happened at Harrell's Crossing. Some of the other officers present seemed equally unhappy, but others, like Mancora and Palzar, only nodded.
"All right."
Garvey shook himself, then stepped briskly across to the map table and looked down at the dispositions indicated on it. He would have given anything to be magically able to transform his command arrangements. Unfortunately, miracles were beyond him, and so he looked up at Barkor and forced himself to radiate confidence in his subordinate.
"I want you to return to your command as quickly as possible, Sir Gere. We can't afford to let them pin us in the pass. There's a good position here."
He tapped the map at a point about 4 miles west of the pass proper, where the Royal Highway passed between a pair of hills. A small farming town named, accurately, if not precisely originally, Green Valley sat in the saddle between them, straddling the highway.
"If you can get there quickly enough, your men can dig in and around the town, and make them come to you. If they refuse to attack you, or try to maneuver around you, it'll buy us time to reinforce you and get more of our men out of the pass. If they don't do either, we'll be able to continue moving out of the pass and around the northeastern edge of your men, as long as you hold your position."
Barkor stared at him, then nodded almost convulsively. Garvey hovered on the point of relieving him and handing command of the rear guard to someone else, like Mancora. But there wasn't time for that either. If he wasted precious hours getting someone else into Barkor's place,
and getting word of the change of command to all of Barkhor's subordinates, Caleb's steadily advancing Marines would be knocking on his army's back door before the first man marched out of his encampment. Of course, that's altogether too likely to happen anyway, if I leave Barkhor in command. But I'm just going to have to take my chances on that. In the meantime, he continued out loud, I'll signal immediate orders to Earl Windshare to harass and delay the enemy. It doesn't sound as if they have any cavalry of their own with them. With any luck, we'll be able to slow them down enough to let you get into position.
Yes, sir.
Barkhor's response sounded strangled, and he cleared his throat harshly.
With your permission, sir, he said in a more normal-sounding voice, I'd best be getting back to my men.
Of course, my lord.
Once again, Garvai projected all the confidence he could as he clasped forearms with Barkhor firmly and thanked God that the Baron couldn't possibly know what he was really thinking. The rest of the army will be right behind you.
Thank you, sir.
Barkhor released Garvai's forearm and headed out of the tent, looking almost like a resolute commander who knew what he was about. Garvai allowed himself a moment to hope there was more truth than usual in that impression, then turned back to the rest of his officers.
My lords, he said, please be thinking about what we have to do while I draft Earl Windshare's instructions. Earl Mancora.
Yes, sir?
It's remotely possible that this is only a diversion intended to panic us into falling back from our current position. To safeguard against that possibility, I want you and your men to stay right where you are. At the same time, however, I want you to begin planning now for a rapid withdrawal if it turns out Caleb really is behind us in strength. Be sure you and Colonel Palzar coordinate the withdrawal of his artillery carefully.
Of course, sir.
As for the rest of us,
Garvai surveyed the other officers around the table.
I want every unit behind Earl Mancora's ready to move west within the next 2 hours.
One or two expressions blanked, and he smiled thinly.
Gentlemen, we're like beads on a string here in this pass. None of us can move until the man immediately to our west is already in motion. Don't think Caleb hasn't considered that either. So yes, 2 hours I said, and 2 hours I meant. Is that clearly understood?
Heads nodded, and his smile turned a bit warmer.
I would recommend that each of you send one of your aides back to your command immediately with instructions to begin preparing to move. I'll try to have all of you personally back to your men as quickly as possible. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Caleb and his mounted bodyguard cantered briskly up the flank of the marching column of Marines. They were accompanied by a 100-man cavalry company, one of the very few the Marines had. It wouldn't be enough to beat off any sort of serious attack, but the entire compact force was fast and agile. Besides, the column was always available for them to fall back on, and if an entire brigade of Marines couldn't stave off an attempt to kill or capture the Emperor, then this entire operation was already effectively doomed. That was Caleb's view of the situation, at any rate, and he was sticking to it. Merlin had done his dead-level best to argue the youthful Emperor into changing his mind, but Caleb was adamant. And Merlin had to agree there was quite a bit of logic on the Emperor's side, whether he liked it or not. For good or ill, Caleb was the only interface through which Merlin was able to directly affect the deployment of the Carizian field force. Merlin certainly couldn't turn up in Brigadier Clarake's command area and start telling him where to move his troops to meet threats his own scouts hadn't detected. Caleb could give whatever orders he wanted, and the troops were rapidly coming to the conclusion that his ability to read a tactical situation on land was just as good as it was at sea. Given that set of circumstances, Merlin had been forced to admit that having Caleb at the point of the Carisian spear made at least some sense. Besides, Caleb was the Emperor, a point he wasn't particularly loath to make whenever it suited his purposes. "It's a good thing he really is smart as a whip," Merlin reflected, as he rode just behind and to the Emperor's right. "Stubborn as he is, we'd be in an incredible mess if he decided to get up on his Emperor's horse this way and he wasn't a bright fellow. I suppose we're fortunate he has the habit of command, too, all things considered. It's a hell of a lot better than indecisiveness, God knows. But I hope Charlian and I can keep him from getting too confident. It's going to be really hard for someone with his authority to avoid the trap of always insisting on going his own way, especially as he gets older." The head of the column came into sight, and Caleb and his escort slowed down as they spotted Brigadier Clarake's mounted command group under the brigade's dovetailed standard, with its embroidered kraken and huge three in scarlet and gold. The brigadier had obviously been informed that they were on their way, and he and his staff trotted to meet the Emperor. "Your Majesty," Clarake said, bowing from the saddle. "Brigadier," Caleb acknowledged. "I hope you won't feel I'm trying to juggle your elbow," the Emperor continued. "But I've discovered that there are only so many times I can sit around safely aboard ship while I send my marines off to get into trouble without me." He'd raised his voice slightly, and Merlin saw several of the nearby marines grinning as they marched past. The Emperor's remarks would spread throughout the brigade within the hour, he felt quite sure. By nightfall, they'd probably have spread through the entire expeditionary force west of the Dark Hills. "Of course, Your Majesty," Clarake agreed with a smile, although Merlin was quite certain that at this particular moment the Brigadier wished Caleb were just about anywhere on safe hold, except with 3rd Brigade. But then Clarake glanced rather oddly in Merlin's direction, and the man who had been Nimu Alban suddenly wondered just how much Clarake really had guessed about him. "Have your scouts reported any sign of Garvai's cavalry?" Caleb asked more seriously, and Clarake grimaced. "My mounted scouts are unfortunately thin on the ground, Your Majesty, and I haven't wanted to let foot patrols get too far out on the column's flanks under the circumstances. So far, we've had a handful of run-ins with the other side's cavalry, but only in ones and twos." "Their scouts running into our scouts," Caleb agreed with a frown of his own. "Has there been any fighting?" "I've had a couple of reports," Clarake nodded. "So far, it's worked out in our favor in each case. On the other hand, I expect I'd only hear back about the ones where it did work out in our favor," he added with a wintry smile. It was Caleb's turn to nod, and he scratched thoughtfully at the wiry whiskers of the short, neatly trimmed beard he'd grown since leaving Karras. He gazed off to the northeast, obviously thinking hard, then looked back at Clarake. "I think we can expect Earl Windshare to come calling," he said. "In fact, I'm a bit surprised he hasn't already arrived. I know we discussed the possibility in our planning sessions, Brigadier, but I've got a feeling he's going to arrive in greater strength than we'd anticipated." "I see, Your Majesty," Clarake said calmly, then let his eyes flick sideways to Captain Athrawes before he looked gravely back at his Emperor. "Do you have any suggestions to make?" "Actually," Caleb said, his own eyes narrowing slightly, "I do. It's occurred to me that the fact that Windshare hasn't arrived yet probably indicates we did take them by surprise. It may also indicate..." he looked directly into Clarake's eyes, that their infantry has been slower about getting into motion than they'd hoped. In fact, I suppose it's even possible Garvai's infantry hasn't actually started moving at all yet. If our spies' reports that Baron Barkor's been placed in command of his rear guard are accurate, I'd say that was certainly at least a possibility, Your Majesty,
Clarake agreed.
Well, if that should be the case, then I'd expect someone like Windshare would be particularly determined to slow us down, especially if he has more of his men with him than we'd anticipated he would. As a matter of fact, I believe he'd probably be looking for an opportunity to do just that by launching a decisive attack on our leading column. Your column, Brigadier.
Yes, Your Majesty.
If he should be tempted to do that, then the opportunity would arise for us to decisively defeat him instead. How confident would you feel about your ability to deal with, say, 3,000 or 4,000 cavalry?
Clarake's eyes narrowed as Caleb threw out the number. He cocked his head to one side, obviously considering the figures, then turned in the saddle to survey the terrain through which he was currently advancing.
"Assuming, of course, that your numbers are close to correct, Your Majesty," he said, flicking another of those lightning glances in Merlin's direction. "And given the openness of most of the ground between here and Green Valley, I think we could handle that many cavalry without too much difficulty. We're more spread out than I might wish, but they aren't going to be able to sneak into charge range without our seeing them in plenty of time to form square."
"I realize that," Caleb said a bit more slowly. "But if you form square, and if Windshare is smart enough and patient enough to simply sit there, he wins. All he really has to do is delay us long enough for Garvai to get his infantry out of Talbor. If he settles for holding you under threat, keeping you formed up in one place in square, instead of continuing to advance, he'll buy Garvai the time he needs.
And you'd like me to tempt him into not being smart and patient enough, Your Majesty?"
"Exactly," Caleb nodded. "Every report I've seen on Windshare says he's aggressive. Someone even described him as thinking with his spurs. I think that's probably unfair. If he's not the sharpest man ever born, he's not exactly stupid either. But his instinct is definitely to hit hard and fast. Given the threat we pose to the rest of Garvai's troops, and the fact that he probably doesn't have the most lively faith in the world in Barkor's quickness off the mark, he's going to be even more tempted to do that if he thinks he sees an opportunity. So I'd like to convince him that he does."
"Risky, if you'll permit me to say so, Your Majesty,"
Clarake observed.
"Agreed. But if you can pull it off, the return could be decisive." "I can see that. At the same time, Your Majesty, I trust you'll forgive me for saying that if I'm about to try something risky, I'd really prefer for you to be somewhere else while I do it."
"Everyone seems to keep saying that to me," Caleb replied with a tight grin. "Unusually, I can talk myself into going along with them. But this time I think not, Brigadier. I'm asking you and your men to run a greater risk than we'd discussed earlier. I'm not going to do that while I sit somewhere in the rear.
Your Majesty, my entire brigade is worth far less to Karis than you are,"
Clarake said bluntly.
"With all due respect, I must respectfully decline to unnecessarily endanger your person in a situation like the one we're discussing."
"Brigadier,"
Caleb began sharply, then made himself bite off his sentence. His jaw clamped for a moment, and then he inhaled sharply.
"You really intend to be stubborn about this, don't you?" "Your Majesty, I'm sorry, but I do."
Clarake faced his monarch squarely.
"It's your prerogative to relieve me of my command if you so choose. But the Empire literally cannot spare you at this time. You know that as well as I do. If you want me to bait a trap for Earl Windshare, I'll do that. But I won't risk your life on the possibility that Windshare might get lucky.
Caleb half glared at Clarake, but the Brigadier didn't flinch. Then his eyes flickered sideways to Merlin for a third time.
Very well, Brigadier, the Emperor said after a long simmering moment. You win, and you're wrong about my prerogative to relieve you.
He showed his teeth.
I'd get away with it about as long as it took for the Empress to find out what you'd done to piss me off.
I'll admit that that thought did occur to me, Your Majesty.
I'm sure it did. However, if I allow you to chase me back to the rear, I'd at least like to leave, call it a personal representative behind. Someone who can report to me in person as soon as whatever happens, happens.
May I assume you have someone in mind for that duty, Your Majesty?
I thought I'd leave Captain Athrawis.
Caleb held Clarake's eyes levelly with his own.
I've always found Merlin's reports extremely accurate, and I trust his judgment.
As do I, Your Majesty.
Clarake smiled ever so slightly.
If you feel you can spare the Sajan's services, I'd be honored to have him remain with the Brigade.
Sir Alec Arthur stood slapping his riding gloves impatiently against his thigh as the courier galloped up to him. He was out of direct contact with the semaphore masts Garvai had ordered constructed all across his rear areas. He could communicate only by old-fashioned dispatch riders, and that left him feeling even more edgy and irritated than he'd been when he received Garvai's original stunning message. Not that he needed much in the way of additional irritation.
Well?
He growled as the courier drew up beside him.
I'm sorry, my lord, the dust-covered young lieutenant replied. The Baron hasn't marched yet.
Then what in the name of Shan Wei is the idiot waiting for?
Windshare snarled. Diplomacy had never been his strong suit, and unlike Garvai, he saw no reason to waste what little diplomacy he had on someone like Barkor.
I may not be the smartest man in the world, he thought savagely, but there's at least one who's a lot stupider than I am, by God.
My lord, I...
the courier began, but Windshare waved him into silence.
Of course you don't have an answer, Lieutenant. That was what General Garvai would have called a rhetorical question.
The cavalry commander surprised himself with a sharp bark of laughter.
Not exactly what people expect out of me, I admit.
The lieutenant, rather wisely, simply nodded this time. Still, it was amazing how much better the exchange made Windshare feel, for the moment at least. He turned and stumped back over to the hilltop near Oak, under whose broad-branched shade he had established his temporary command post. Dry seed cones crunched under his boots, and he found himself wishing the crunching sounds could have been coming from Baron Barkor. His staff looked up at him, and he grimaced disgustedly.
The fat arsed idiot hasn't even started marching yet, he growled.
Very few of his staff saw any more reason than he did to conceal their opinions of Barkor, and one or two of them actually spat on the ground.
My lord, if he doesn't start moving soon, then this army is well and truly fucked,
Sir Nathan Galvan said harshly. Major Galvan was Windshare's senior aide, effectively his chief of staff, although the Coruscantian army didn't use that particular term. Like virtually all of Windshare's other officers, Galvan was exceedingly well-born. That was inevitable, given the fact that the cavalry tended to attract the nobly born like a particularly powerful lodestone. There was nothing wrong with Galvan's brain, however, and Windshare knew he tended to lean on the major.
I know, Nathan, I know,
he said, and looked out from the small hill, glaring at the dust clouds rising above the local turnpike which connected with the Royal Highway less than 3 miles from where he stood at this very moment. Galvan was right about what was going to happen if the Carizians managed to seal the western end of Talbor Pass while Garvai's army was still trapped inside. Unfortunately, everyone seemed to understand that, except the one man responsible for getting the army's rear guard the hell out into the open to prevent it from happening. Windshare didn't want to admit just how desperate he was beginning to feel. Caleb's move to flank Talbor by landing a force west of it had scarcely been unexpected, but his ability to somehow eliminate the observation posts specifically placed to detect any such landing definitely was. He'd used the advantage of surprise he'd gained ruthlessly, and at this point, Windshare hadn't even been able to form a clear, hard notion of how many men were ashore. It wasn't for lack of trying, but against an army whose every soldier was equipped with a rifle, his cavalry patrols hadn't been able to get as close to the Carizian columns as he would have liked. It wasn't his troopers' fault. His men had no shortage of courage or horsemanship, but the ability of cavalry armed with lances, sabers, and horsebows or arbalests to stand up to massed rifle fire was limited at best. The only real advantages the horsemen retained were mobility and speed, and neither of those was great enough to offset their newfound disadvantages. The worst of it was that cavalry required open terrain if it was going to operate efficiently, but open terrain only allowed riflemen to begin killing them sooner, at longer ranges. And most of the terrain between Caleb's landing point and Green Valley consisted of rolling open grasslands, rising steadily towards the east as they merged with the Dark Hills' western foothills. In light of his scout's inability to maintain close contact with the enemy, his notion of the Carizian strength was problematical at best. The most anyone could say on the basis of the reports he'd received so far was that Caleb had landed somewhere between 10,000 and 18,000 men. Windshare personally inclined towards the lower figure, but he was frustratingly aware that he had nothing concrete upon which to base his feeling. And even if Caleb had only 10,000 men with him, Windshare had less than 4,000 of his cavalry actually present. Another 8,000 of them were scattered along the line of the Dark Hills, watching the passes farther north from Talbor. But there was no way to recall any of those detachments in time to do any good. So here he sat, with not quite 4,000 men and orders to harass a numerically superior force, equipped with much longer-ranged weapons, in order to delay its advance until Baron Barkor got his thumb out of his arse.
Which, at this rate, isn't going to happen before Langhorne returns to gather up the world, he thought disgustedly. All right, Nathan, he said finally, turning back from the oncoming dust clouds. We're going to have to do something, and you're right, we're going to have to do it quickly. I want everyone we've got moved to those cotton silk plantations west of Green Valley. Their columns are going to have to tighten up where the highway passes through that belt of woodland. I know it's not very deep, but it should at least cramp them, and the ground on this side of the woods is the best place we're going to find for cavalry.
Sir, those woods aren't that thick or overgrown. Certainly not anything like the approaches to Harrell's Crossing. Loose order infantry can probably get through them without a lot of difficulty, and if they send riflemen forward into the trees, they'll be able to use them for cover and...
Don't worry, I'm not planning on deploying a nice juicy target for them inside rifle range. I'm not going to object if they do waste time sending their marksmen into those woods, mind you. What I'm thinking, though, is that there's that nice rising slope this side of the woods.
If we take position just over its crest, and they know we're there, they won't be able to shoot at us, but they'll have to respect the possibility of a charge. If nothing else, it should encourage them to halt in place until they can bring up additional infantry. And given the fact that they don't seem to have any cavalry of their own on this side of the mountains, they may not realize we're there in strength at all. If they advance up that slope, away from the protection of the woods, and get close enough to us...
He let his voice trail off, and Galvan started nodding. Slowly at first, and then with increasing enthusiasm. Much as the Major respected Windshare as a fighter, he wouldn't have trusted the Earl as a strategist. He was the ideal regimental or divisional commander in many ways, but he probably would have been a disaster as an army commander. One of his virtues, however, was an excellent eye for terrain, and he was right. The plantation's fields, covered in roughly knee-high cotton silk plants, offered a stretch of fairly level ground almost 4 miles wide. It was a fan-shaped stretch, widest at its western end and narrowing as it climbed towards the east. And, as Windshare had just pointed out, the land along its eastern edge broke down into a shallow trough before it started climbing again. The resultant depression was big enough, probably, to allow Windshare to conceal the bulk of his cavalry from the approaching Carizians until they were right on top of him. Nothing could magically erase the advantage the Carizians' rifles bestowed upon them, but Windshare's chosen spot was the closest thing to ideal ground they were likely to find. Aside, of course, from the fact that it was barely a mile and a half west of Green Valley. If they couldn't convince the Carizians to halt there, it was virtually certain Caleb's Marines would take Green Valley without a fight. And if they held Green Valley, the chances of any infantry force breaking out of Talbert Pass would be slim. "Yes, my lord," he said now. "I'll see to it at once."
"Excuse me, Brigadier."
Brigadier Kint Clarake looked up from his conversation with Colonel Artu Reisengear, the commanding officer of the 2/3 Marines.
"Yes, Captain Athrawes." "I wonder if I might have a word," Merlin asked diffidently.
Clarake looked at him thoughtfully for a moment, then nodded.
"I need to catch up with Colonel Johnston's battalion anyway, Sergeant Merlin," he said. "Why don't you ride along with me?"
"Thank you, sir," Merlin replied, and waited until Clarake had mounted his horse once again. Caleb surrendered to Clarake's insistence that he had no place at the point of the spear had surprised Merlin more than a little, and, truth to tell, it had left him in two minds. On the one hand, he was delighted to get Caleb back where he belonged. On the other hand, Caleb's decision to leave him behind had made him feel undeniably uneasy. The rest of Caleb's bodyguards, not to mention the cavalry company surrounding him, ought to be capable of dealing with anything the Emperor might run into. But Merlin had already lost Caleb's father. Whether that had been his fault or not, he still felt bitter regret every time he thought about King Harald's death, and he had no intention of feeling that way over Caleb's death.
"Then there's that other minor consideration,"
he thought dryly as Clarake concluded his brief conversation with Reisengear and headed for his horse.
"I could wish I'd had a little more time to think about how I'd handle this situation. I'm not even sure whether all those glances in my direction meant what I thought they did or not."
He snorted suddenly in amusement.
"Now, if I were still Nemu, I could think of another reason for him to have been doing that. And, truth to tell, he's cute enough, I don't think I'd have minded it at all."
He managed not to smile as he watched the brigadier swing gracefully into the saddle. Unlike too many Marine officers, Clarak obviously felt right at home on a horse's back as he fell easily into place beside Merlin's mount.
"And he's got really nice buns, too," Merlin thought.
"Now, Sajan Merlin," Clarak said, thankfully unaware of the Sajan's appreciative thoughts, as the two of them started forward, followed at a respectful distance by Major Lofton and the other members of Clarak's command group.
"I believe you had something to say to me which you'd prefer no one else heard?" "Well, that answers that question, doesn't it, Sajan Merlin?"
Merlin thought sardonically.
"I beg your pardon, Brigadier," he said politely aloud. "I realize I'm not really supposed to know this, Sajan," Clarak said with a crooked smile. "But I didn't spend that long working with you, the Emperor, and Baron Seamount without realizing you're considerably more than just one of the Emperor's bodyguards, or even just a Sajan who happens to know all sorts of interesting things and have even more interesting ideas. I still remember how neatly you maneuvered me into suggesting the creation of the scout snipers, for instance, and who it was who suggested the name for them. And I suppose I should go ahead and admit I've heard a few whispers of rumors about visions of yours. In fact, I found myself wondering on occasion just how much of the Emperor's uncanny ability to predict what the enemy is likely to do stems from those visions you may or may not be having."
Merlin managed not to wince, but only because he'd already suspected at least some of what was coming. He hadn't anticipated the full of it, however, and he found himself wondering if Clarak was still holding back even more suspicions.
"Well, you knew he was a smart man when you and Caleb picked him to develop the new infantry tactics. It would appear he's even sharper than you'd realize, though, and sharp blades tend to nick fingers if you handle them carelessly. So I think it's about time you started handling this one the right way." "Brigadier," he said, "obviously I can't go into all of that without the Emperor's permission. On the other hand, there's not much point pretending you aren't generally correct. I do have visions, of a sort at least, and they have been quite useful to the Emperor and to his father on several occasions, which, for obvious reasons, explains why all of us have been to some pains to prevent the rumors you referred to from getting any sort of broad circulation."
"I can see why that would be, yes," Clarak agreed.
"Since you've figured out at least some of it, I suppose I should go ahead and tell you that while I can see many things, I can see neither the future nor the past, only the present. Obviously, even that much can sometimes provide a major advantage, but it means, for example, that I couldn't simply buff up my crystal ball, and no, I don't actually use one, and tell Caleb ahead of time what Garvai and Windshare would do when they found out we'd landed behind them."
Clarak pursed his lips thoughtfully, then nodded, and Merlin continued.
"Although I can't see the future, I can tell you Earl Windshare is assembling the better part of 4,000 troopers about another 2 miles down the road from here. It's actually quite a good position from his perspective, and I believe he's counting on the terrain to keep you from realizing how close he is until you blunder into him.
Which presents a possible opportunity to carry out His Majesty's intentions," Clarak said thoughtfully.
"Yes, it does, but the place he's found gives him a much better chance of actually pressing home a charge than I think Caleb wanted you to give him."
"Maybe so, but if his position is that good, then if we can't entice him into charging, we'll be forced to stop, at least until Brigadier Hayman can come up to support us.
so it's either find a way to convince him to fight, or else let him pin us down, possibly long enough for Garvai to get out of the trap.
Merlin nodded, and Clarake frowned pensively.
Tell me more about this terrain Windshare's chosen, Sajin, he said.
The Earl of Windshare frowned, listening carefully as rifle shots popped distantly on the other side of the crest line. They were coming steadily closer, and he hoped his forward pickets weren't taking too many casualties.
Damned rifles, he thought resentfully.
He remembered his own incredulity at Harrell's Crossing, when the rifles hidden in the woods had opened up on him. At first, he'd literally been unable to believe it was happening. No one could possibly shoot that far or that rapidly. The very idea had been unthinkable. Unfortunately, the Carizians could. Windshare couldn't quite agree with Garvai's opinion that the new rifles were going to overturn all accepted battlefield tactics, just as their galleons had already overturned all accepted naval tactics. But even he had to admit the consequences were going to be profound. He wasn't prepared to assume they'd just made cavalry obsolete as a decisive arm, but he was honest enough to admit that at least part of that reluctance might be pure bull-headed stubbornness on his part. A war in which cavalry was reduced solely to a scouting force, capable of occasional hit-and-run raids but helpless against any unshaken infantry position? No sense. Ridiculous. Unthinkable. Yet vehemently as Windshare had rejected the notion, he couldn't free himself of a gnawing suspicion that Garvai had a point. Even at an extended gallop, a typical cavalryman could cover less than 500 yards in a minute. Against slow-firing smoothbore matchlocks, with a maximum effective range of no more than 100 yards, that meant musketeers would have time for only a single shot each before the horsemen were on top of them. But these damned Carizian rifles fired four or five times as rapidly as matchlocks, and to four or five times the effective range. Which was the reason the skirmishers deployed to screen the oncoming infantry columns were able to keep Windshare's scouts at a distance. By the same token, the skirmishers had to stay close enough to their columns to fall back on them if they were threatened by a cavalry charge. But the ability of an infantry force to move virtually at will, even in the presence of superior numbers of cavalry, seemed like a perversion to an old-school trooper like Windshare.
Well, Corrin may have a point, Windshare granted unwillingly. I still think he's overreacting to what happened at Harrell's Crossing, but I'm willing to admit I could be wrong about that. Even if I am, though, those bastards don't have a single pikeman. If they'll just come close enough.
My lord?
Windshare shook himself up out of his introspection as Galvan trotted up beside him.
Yes, Nathan.
They have two battalions on this side of the woodline. Another is just beginning to emerge, but they've allowed the marching interval between it and the other two to widen to over 300 yards.
They have?
Windshare's eyes brightened, and Galvan smiled.
Yes, my lord, and their lead battalion is heading straight towards us. Our pickets are falling back in front of it as you instructed. That's the firing you can hear.
He twitched his head in the direction of the whip-crack rifle shots.
They've kept the range open, too, just like they were supposed to, and we haven't lost very many men. We've got over a dozen horses down, but I think we've only had two or three men hit.
Good!
Windshare slapped his gauntlets against his thigh.
Good, Nathan!
The Earl climbed back into his own saddle and looked around at his staff.
Gentlemen, I believe it's time we discouraged these people, he said.
Merlin Athrawes found himself hoping Brigadier Clarake wasn't being overconfident. His two lead battalions, Colonel Johnston's 1st Battalion and Colonel Raisingear's 2nd Battalion, which made up the 3rd Brigade's 1st Regiment, marched straight along the Royal Highway towards Green Valley, in time with the battalion pipers and with rifles slung. Although their battle casualties